My name is Ari Lannis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by two very special guests, Rabbi Or Rose and Celine Ibrahim, two of the three co-directors of CIRCLE, the Center for Interreligious and Communal Leadership Education, based up in the Boston area. They are leaders in bringing the skill of interfaith into our training of clergy and religious leaders, and have much insight to share with us on this topic. Thanks for listening, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Rabbi Or Rose and Celine Ibrahim, two out of the three directors at the CIRCLE program, which is a joint initiative between Hebrew College and the Andover Newton Theological School, training seminarians and aspiring religious leaders in the art and skill of interfaith, which we will get into. Also, Rabbi Or Rose is one of the founding faculty members at Hebrew College, and Celine is a chaplain at Tufts University. So we have a lot of people who are really invested and interested in religion, higher education, and training people to do interfaith. This should be really interesting. And so thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, just to start out, there are not many seminaries out there that do focus on interfaith or multifaith as a skill for religious leaders. It's probably something that's increasing, but I'm curious how you came to feeling like that is an important part of the skill of being a religious leader in the United States right now. And is it a field that you see expanding? What are some of the trends that you're seeing?
Thank you. I came to Hebrew College 12 years ago with my mentor, Rabbi Arthur Green, and a few other academics and teachers to help create the rabbinical school. And we were given the unusual gift of being located side by side with Andover Newton Theological School. And so with the urging both of administrators and students, we began to explore the relationship that could exist in what has become a very exciting and vibrant laboratory for interreligious learning and leadership. Among the lessons that we've learned over the years is that in this increasingly globalized world, in which people who believe and practice differently are interacting with each other both virtually and in person, that we need leaders who are capable of helping their communities engage productively for the common good. And that means discovering and engaging both similarity and difference. So I think it is critical to the work of religious leaders, particularly in the United States, which, as you know, is a highly religiously diverse country. And of course, hand in hand with the experience of religious diversity that people are encountering across religious lines, we also know that in this country in particular, the identities of many people are blended in different ways than they once were. So when you talk about religious diversity, it's also an experience that we all are now familiar with, internal to the Jewish, Christian, or Muslim communities. So given that kind of more intensive engagement and its different manifestations, including hybridity for some, we need it in order to try and further develop and sustain a healthy civil society.
And so, Celine, how did you get involved in this quest, so to speak?
So my primary theological training was at Harvard Divinity School, which at that time was at the forefront, really, of thinking about what a multi-faith group of students can do with one another in bumping up against one another in classes and things. And that was where my primary training in both theological thinking and in the practice of ministry in communities was formed. And I came there as a Muslim student, one of the first, if not the first, in their MDiv track, so their Masters of Divinity track. And so I was actively thinking about the intersection between theory and Islamic studies and then what was happening on the ground in the communities that I saw myself serving. And so from that position, when I heard about Andover Newton Theological School and Hebrew College's partnership, and they were at that time looking for someone to help spearhead their Muslim initiatives, and not just looking for someone who could teach Islamic studies, but someone who could be the community liaison mm-hmm. in many ways for practicing Muslims on the ground. So I came into the work even as a consultant, even before there was a formal position established, working on our fellowship program, which takes students at Hebrew College and Andover Newton and also Muslim community fellows and gives them an experience as a cohort of fellows, but also working intensively with one other person across religious lines over the course of a year on a joint project. And what we find is that more than any other component of the fellowship program, people hold on to that intimate partnership that they form with another faith leader in training. And as we are now surveying our alums who are 7 or 8 years out, some of them, from Circle, we see that they maintain these partnerships. And when they go out and serve their home congregations, they are actively still in dialogue with the people who formed their theological conversation partners mm-hmm. and yeah. grassroots activist partners.
And the Muslim students who are involved, where are they situated? Because there's no Muslim seminary equivalent. So how are they finding the program?
Exactly. So many of our fellows come from Islamic studies programs from the rich Boston mm-hmm. landscape. So people out of course, Harvard Divinity School and people at BU who are doing Islamic studies and other pockets. Most of the fellows are on an Islamic studies track, but also have a deep engagement with different facets of the Muslim community life on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, Boston strikes me as like one of the best places to be able to do something like this because there's so many different institutions between Harvard and rabbinical schools and that are doing religious studies. So you're connected to all of that and kind of bringing people in through all of that.
Absolutely. Hebrew College is the newest member of the Boston Theological Institute. There were 9 Christian schools, and we like to quip that we have made the minion. We are the 10th. And increasingly, with Celine's help, we've been engaging with the growing Muslim community in the greater Boston area. To return just to one point that Celine made a moment ago, one of the terms from Jewish tradition that I have used over the years in describing the kind of work that we do is to use the image of a chavruta study pair from the ancient rabbinic tradition in which people engage as peers, as fellow learners. And that's been an important model for us in terms of administrators that work together, faculty that work together, students that work together. And as you might know from your own Jewish educational experience, a chavruta learning environment involves, yes, of course, studying the text that is before you, but it also is about this intensely dialogical experience that means that you are studying the face of the person who was across mm-hmm. from you and all of the life issues that emanate from conversation and from text study. And I'm happy to report that over the years, those kinds of conversations and projects have grown beautifully. And many of the people that have been fellows in our program, and certainly we as staff and faculty and administrators, feel like we are connected to one another in ways that we could not have expected just a few years ago. It's been a real blessing.
Well, it's so interesting you put it in the frame of chavruta, because I actually have, from my time as a student at NYU, a specific Muslim friend of mine, Ibad, who is now doing a PhD in Islamic studies at Columbia, but we took the president of the university's class together, and then we actually TA'd it together. And the class is about baseball and religion. And so we studied philosophy of religion and baseball, and we're still friends to this day, and we still get together and talk about it. But he, in a lot of ways, especially towards the end of my college life, was really this chavruta for thinking about religion.
Part of our fellowship model works on this third thing model for you. In this case, it was the interest in baseball. And many of our fellows share a joint interest, for instance, in environmental ethics and the climate change movement, or the anti-climate change movement, I should say. And other fellowship prayers work, for instance, on women's leadership and the roles in our different communities for women leaders. It's a very rich experience when you have similar goals but slightly different frameworks to which you're shepherding your various communities to reach that goal.
I'm curious, so this, I mean, to me, just anecdotally, this seems like very, I don't want to use a buzzword, but cutting edge for thinking about training of religious leaders to think of interfaith as like a competency within that. And so I'm curious, like, as a long-term vision, how broad or how big is this going to be part of what you're doing? Like, how much should this be part of our education of religious leaders?
From my perspective, I think that interreligious skills and competencies, as you're describing them, are essential for all religious leaders at the beginning of the 21st century. And the question is, what are the models that are going to emerge? And we're well aware that ours is but one. And we're certainly not alone in this burgeoning field. And one of the exciting elements of the growth of the interreligious engagement field is that there are a whole slew of conversations that are taking place, including, for example, the fact that you and I have met before, and that there's an extended network of people that are really trying to ask, what are the skills and experiences and the knowledge, to paraphrase our friend and colleague Ibu Patel, that are necessary to do this work well? And as we all know, it's exciting because in some ways it is new in terms of the focus, the attention that's given to interfaith or interreligious engagement as a discipline. It's also anxiety provoking because we don't have decades, centuries of modeling before us. There have certainly been instances historically of individuals and communities that have worked together in beautiful ways, but as an emerging field, it's one that we are actively working on together with other people who are asking similar and different questions with the same kinds of hopes and dreams for, you know, better relationships across religious lines.
Our third partner in this work is Associate Professor at Andover Newton, Jennifer Peace, and her focus has been the institutional change mechanisms of interreligious work. So we're not only interested in one-off events or individual partnerships, but we're also thinking about how to make sustainable change in institutions that, that have the longevity and the staying power to really shape the future of theological education and the public discourse as well.
Right. And one way that's been manifest to date at Circle is that we are attentive to the fact that there are students that come into our programs very excited about the interreligious possibilities, and others that do not have as much excitement or experience. And so what we've tried to do, to the best of our abilities, is create holistic set of opportunities, some of which are more intensive and others are less intensive. So it could be that someone will come to a public lecture, but we try and give that person or those people opportunities for further engagement. Right. So not everyone is going to become a circle fellow, right, as we described, but there are lectures, there are study mm-hmm. groups, there are fellowships, there are jointly taught courses. So we're hoping that by having this menu of engagement opportunities that we can help to create a particular kind of interreligious ethos.
Right. That's interesting. It strikes me as almost opening like a new branch of education, the way that you think of, like, I know a lot of my friends in rabbinical school, they think, do I want to be a rabbi of a pulpit or a community? And the same thing would be for many religions. Do I want to teach in a school? Am I going to go more the academic route? Do I want to work on a campus? And it seems like interfaith is almost another, I mean, there's a lot of overlap with some of these categories, but it's another form of training. Like, I'm going to be one of the people who, my primary responsibility is actually to work with a lot of people who aren't like me, and that could be critically important for a broader community to have people who do that.
So we're shaping a field and positions on their own, but we're also making an argument that anyone who's working in the sphere mm-hmm. of leading religious communities needs to have at least a baseline literacy mm-hmm. in how to engage interreligiously.
Yeah.
And preferably they also have tradition-specific information that can help mm-hmm. them be even more effective. And I think that goes back to what Orr said, is just finding where people want to plug in to the work yeah. and you know, how it relates to their own goals and professional ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as we, you know, continue to wade more deeply into this work, mm-hmm. we are also trying to ask, again, from a field-building perspective, what does excellence look like? Mm. And we've had a number of very fruitful conversations with people locally and nationally. So what does it mean to have basic literacy or a basic set of mm-hmm. experiences? And then what does it mean to graduate to more sophisticated
yeah.
and more in-depth experiences so that someone feels like they have a particular kind of mm-hmm. expertise or a series of learnings and experiences that position them best for the various kinds of interreligious work that yeah. the world needs. And as Celine said a moment ago, in a Jewish context, it could mean that a person very much wants to pursue a career as a pulpit rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to try and help them explore how they will engage the interreligious dimensions of that work.
Yeah.
It could be someone right. that works on a college campus where there is a more explicit mm-hmm. day-to-day mandate to be engaging with students from a variety of religious traditions. But in either case, there are some overlapping mm-hmm. skills and
should be in your knowledge somewhere,
bases, etc., that are important.
We're also encouraging religious leaders who have been in the field for a number of years, maybe before interfaith mm-hmm. became as widespread or popular as it is.
Yeah.
We're helping these folks to continue to enrich what yeah. they're capable of, you know, how the ways in which they're capable of facilitating interreligious relations mm-hmm. with their congregation. So we're not only working with theological students, but then we have this layer where we're working with religious leaders, primarily in the Boston area, but also nationally as well, trying to make sure that we're pushing this momentum forward at various levels.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that we're talking about this because in a previous podcast episode when I was talking to Eboo Patel, he mentioned that the two things he thinks the interfaith movement needs to work on most in the future are definitions and metrics, like definitions of what are the goals and processes and things that interfaith work is like actually about, and definitions for like what are we talking about when we say interfaith and multifaith. And I know one of the things that I spend exceptional amount of time on here is figuring out how to assess and build learning outcomes that are like building on each other and to track our students progressing. And we also have some of this curricular focus because we have a minor in multi-faith mm-hmm. and spiritual leadership that, as I know, especially where you know, Chalit and Yehuda teach right. in. And it's such a it's almost like building a field of study that 15 years ago was so foreign. It's just a lot of building that needs to happen. Right.
To reiterate the point that I made previously and to add to the insights that you both just offered, that's why it's so important for there to be this kind of cross-fertilization. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if we think we have the recipe in-house on our hilltop. We need constant engagement with people that are involved in this work in different sectors of society. We need to hear from Ibu and his colleagues at IFYC about what they're learning and discovering. We need to hear from you and your colleagues at NYU about what you're learning and discovering, especially because what we're trying to do is to train religious leaders or augment the training of religious leaders for service in the broader world. So it's been a wonderful opportunity to remove some of the scaffolding that, that often exists between institutions or sectors of society. So we can't afford to work in silos. And, you know, as you mentioned, metrics and curricula, we're trying to think as creatively with other good people as we possibly can.
And so I'm curious maybe to flip this conversation to like the other side of this coin. What have been the hardest parts? So what are the biggest challenges? And, you know, that question is both for you as people who are Muslim and Jewish doing this, but also just thinking about it as an educator and curricular, like what have been the hardest things so far in kind of building a lot of these materials?
Or Jenny and I co-teach an interreligious leadership intensive course, and we've started to build into that course an awareness of how racial and ethnic identities, how gender identities, and various other components of people's personalities and affiliations in the world intersect with their religious identities as well. And so thinking in that complex, very nuanced way, while simultaneously giving folks practical skills, that's been, it's not impossible, but it does require a substantial bit of pedagogical thinking for how to go about it best. The other thing we're trying to do is break down these big silos. Jewish, Christian, Muslim, of course, is one that's being thrown out. But then if you hone in on any one of those larger categories, you see that the landscape is incredibly more complex. So giving people the tools to think about the intersections between religious identities and other identities, as well as the tools to think about intra-religious diversity.
Well said. I would just add briefly that in the context of seminaries where students are coming for a deep dive into their traditions, we want and need to respect that kind of intensive exploration of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and at the same time provide them with opportunities in an integrated way to think about how those learnings can be supplemented, can be deepened with an interreligious lens and experiences with people that believe and practice very differently than they do. Of course, as Celine just said, part of what happens in that dynamic process of encounter with people that you experience as more similar and more different is that you come to a place of a more nuanced vision, we hope and pray, of your own identity and the identities of other people. But, you know, an ongoing question, which I'm sure you deal with regularly in your work, is the dynamic, the tension between universality and particularity, and how we move along that continuum.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, individual students, I've noticed a lot, have very different approaches to interfaith and like why they're coming to the table, often related to where they fall on the spectrum of a universalist ethic, or they're much more particularistic in their religious traditions. Like, really interesting to me to see how an evangelical Christian student and like a really liberal Jewish student can come to the same conversation with like totally different assumptions as to why they're even in the room in the first place. And it can still be really productive, and often forcing them to think about that is the part that's most productive. But it really gets at how many different layers intra and inter there are at the same time, and how they're completely informing each other.
You hit on what we often discuss as another benefit of the interreligious encounter, is that you as a person deepen your own ability to articulate what it is you think, believe, and why. And the other person develops a greater ability to hear about ideas that are radically different from their own and take a moment to understand them conceptually, even if they don't agree with them. And so it's this basic skill I think we need more in the world, more broadly, even beyond religious communities, of being able to engage deeply with different ideas in a respectful manner, where you're holding up the dignity of the other person, your interlocutor.
Yeah. I've actually, and I don't know whether I am completely sold on what I'm about to say, but it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently, whether the most important skill that a really deep interfaith experience can have is almost holding an interaction with someone who's so different than you for just an extended period of time, and being forced to accept that difference and still just sit there and sit and be with it and kind of accept that as your relationship with this person. It just seems like a very valuable life skill. I'm not sure whether I really believe that's the most important thing you can get out of it, but I think I might. It strikes me as something that like the average college student should leave college knowing how to do that. Like, that just seems like a very useful life skill, and I don't even know if I'm very good at it. I don't know many people who really are.
I think you're raising one of the key elements of the work that we share in, which is, how do you engage with people who do in fact hold views that are quite different from yours, even as you share in a project of creating a community, whether it's the Hilltop in Newton or whether it's at the NYU campus or it's in the broader American civil context or the global context in which we find ourselves thrust into. And obviously, you know, conducting this interview, given all of the things that are happening in the world, we know how complicated that can be. I just want to add, too, that for some people, it's also difficult and challenging to experience what they think of as being their own is actually shared by other people. So I don't want to say that that people can create absolute sameness, but again, the dynamic between similarity and difference in all of its hues and colors can be disruptive in terms of our sense of self and of community. So it's a complicated business to be a part of.
I have a bit of an inside baseball question for you, or about rabbinical schools. And because as someone who, just personally, I have many, many friends in rabbinical schools, and that cut a swath from Yeshiva University to Reconstructionist to non-denominational, kind of every school that there is, I kind of have a friend who's in. And I'm curious, and then maybe we could talk about this for the Muslim community also, but how much do you see this increasing sense that interfaith and multifaith are a skill that need to be honed by religious leaders, being accepted within the Jewish world more broadly? Is it increasing acceptance, or has a certain subset kind of accepted it, but it's not really expanding beyond that? Like, where do you see that going within the Jewish community more broadly?
I think over the last decade or so, there has been growth of an interest and a commitment to interreligious education in several of the rabbinical schools in the United States and beyond. And I'm in regular contact with educators from other Jewish seminaries. That has been a real gift. And we share in various initiatives, and we have written pieces together and so forth. So It's not something that everyone has taken up, but I have had substantive conversations with colleagues in Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative, and Orthodox seminaries about these issues. And I'm excited to say that the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation provided us with a small grant to convene Jewish educators in seminaries to talk about best practices mm-hmm. and ongoing challenges. So we're going to do that in the spring of 2016. So
it's exciting.
It's an important moment, I hope, in terms of our further development and honing our craft. And I just want to say that part of the idea for this gathering was based on my experience attending a larger gathering of this sort convened by the Association of Theological Schools for Christian educators mm-hmm. in seminaries. And I was just so intrigued and excited to see how people in that context, where there were real differences of opinion about the issues on the table, work together. And I was one of the non-Christian observer mm-hmm. participants in it. So I learned something important from that experience, and I'm trying to see with my Jewish colleagues mm-hmm. where it will lead us.
For the Muslim community in the United States, many people who perform key religious functions, mm-hmm. such as giving Friday sermons or running social service agencies, come from backgrounds where they might also have a day job as a civil engineer right. or as a doctor. Mm-hmm. And the level of religious literacy is fairly strong among American Muslims, but yet you're starting to see a demographic of people who are American-born and American-raised or who have been here for a substantial amount of time who are seeing as their primary vocation mm-hmm. religious leadership.
Yeah.
So this... this has called, let me say, this dynamic creates a need for extensive training programs. Mm-hmm. And I think to compare what it takes to produce an educated Muslim scholar is around the same amount of time that it takes to produce a rabbi.
Right.
And so the Muslim community in particular is faced with this challenge of figuring out how to sustain institutions and provide the environments where students can study over multiple years mm-hmm. while still building out its physical infrastructure
right.
in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mosques themselves and cultural centers are severely understaffed mm-hmm. and there's very few mosques in the United States where there's even paid mm-hmm. staff to begin with.
Yeah.
And so we're thinking about theological education in Islamic studies and all the related disciplines. At the same time, we're doing a little bit of
right.
the brick and mortar building.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me as one of the areas that I think at NYU we're so lucky is that we have Imam Khalid as a full-time imam with us. And our Muslim students are, I know, very... they love him and they're very appreciative, but it really makes a huge difference for what... just the organizational structure that's in place and how I think people sometimes don't realize how much of an impact that can have on just who's at the table. Mm-hmm. Any other last thoughts or anything you'd like to...
Two last thoughts. One is looking back and one is looking forward. Looking back, I just want to say personally that I benefited tremendously from mentors and role models who paved the way long before I thought about any of this in serious and focused ways. And part of what led me to this work, specifically in the context of a rabbinical school and with seminarians and those training for religious leadership, is the fact that many of those role models did not have the support and the guidance of schools or institutions. They were pioneers. And I want to make sure that this is not left to chance.
Right.
That it isn't just the particularly enthusiastic or entrepreneurial interreligious spirit that is engaging in this work and receiving training in this area, but that we weave it into the fabric of seminary education. Looking forward, I want to say that one of the lessons from Circle and from my relationships with Jenny and Celine specifically is that this work requires the cultivation of relationships. And in a world in which we are experiencing the aches and pains of religious intolerance, of violence, and the like, we need to invest in relationships with people, with organizations, with institutions that are willing to walk together, knowing that the road is sometimes uneven, to say the least, and that we're going to fall into some potholes, and that it requires a certain kind of hope that is built upon the foundation of trust in real relationships, because it's hard sometimes reading the newspaper or turning on the radio or watching a television segment about the latest explosive event in some part of the world, near or far, and then to wake up the next morning and continue this work. And so to be in the company of colleagues like Jenny and Celine, and as I said before, to be a part of an extended network of people for whom this is a passion, a commitment, is so important.
I don't think I could have said a better ending. I feel like we should just end the podcast there and call it a day. Thank you both so much for coming in today. We will definitely have you back at some point. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Special thank you to our guests, Rabbi Ora Rose and Celine Ibrahim, for such a fun and interesting conversation. Special thank you to Brian Young, as always, editing, producing, and Lord Overlord of the podcast. I think you should leave that in. We should leave this whole little bit in. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We love getting those 5-star reviews. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you back for another episode.